and welcome to this episode of ChapCast. My name is Jennifer Kennedy, and I am the VP for Quality and Standards at CHAP. And what we're going to be discussing in this episode of ChapCast is the changes that are coming to hospice providers as it relates to survey process and enforcement remedies. And I am so honored to be joined by my good friend, Kim Skehan. Kim, can you tell us a little bit about where you're from and what you do?
Sure. Thank you, Jennifer. And it's really a pleasure to be here with you and with your CHAP members and hospice providers today. I am an RN. It is my 35th year in hospice and home health, in all levels of hospice, as you can imagine, from direct care all the way through management, administration, with the bulk of my career focusing on my what is my current role, which is Director of Compliance, Regulatory, and Quality. I work for Symmetry Healthcare Consulting. I've been with Legacy Simeone Healthcare Consultants, who then merged with Blacktree Healthcare Consultants this past year. And we oversee all of the survey and regulatory components to the services that we provide for home health and hospice providers. Our survey readiness and follow-up team is made up of current, former, and certified surveyors. So I'm very proud of the work that we do in supporting providers as well as the accrediting organizations and survey agencies in supporting regulatory compliance.
You know, Kim, that's great. And I'm glad you mentioned all those people that you're serving in your role. And we're so happy that Symmetry is the partner that they are to CHAP. So thank you and Symmetry for being that great partner to us. So I wanted us to sort of open the conversation today about how we got here. How did we even get to talking about new regulations that are now in effect and are impacting hospice providers out there?
So Jennifer, that is a great question, and certainly one that many hospice providers have been asking over the past several months. And there really are three key factors. And the first is, as we know, CMS's interest in survey reforms for hospices has been in place for a long time. We remember back to the Impact Act of 2014 that required surveys every 36 months. That original act was in place through 2025. However, with the Home Health Final Rule and the Hospice Act, it is now made permanent with these statutory and regulatory reforms. Second, the Office of Inspector General has looked closely at survey issues in hospice, notably in July of 2019, with two reports that most hospices are familiar with, where the reports focused on the overall quality of care provided to hospice beneficiaries and deficiencies found by surveyors, as well as 12 cases of harm to beneficiaries receiving hospice care, which the OIG reported that revealed vulnerabilities in CMS's efforts to prevent and address harm. And it's these reports and this increasing need for directive to have increased oversight sparked these regulatory and statutory reforms that are being implemented today. And then third, as an industry, we've long seen the discrepancies and inconsistencies between survey agencies and regions and states, and even with individual surveyors. Our organization, since we do survey across the country, as does CHAP, we see the discrepancies, again, that can be one surveyor or one survey entity, or even within state survey agencies and in regions or in different states. We have the ability to be able to look at the QCOR website for state survey findings at this point in time, that can often, you can see the differences in states or regions that have higher levels of condition level deficiencies, for example, than others, and also increased findings. So the goal of the reforms by CMS is to improve consistency and accuracy in the survey process, while also adding survey enforcement remedies, which are already in place for other settings.
So, you know, as a longtime hospice nurse, I have to tell you, it was really difficult for me to read those two reports from the OIG that came out in 2019, especially the one that cited the 12 cases of potential harm. There is no room in my mind for any patient to have to go through the experiences that those patients went through in those cited cases. And, it really puts a focus and a spotlight on how regulations are the foundation for quality of care. And, you have your baseline for regulatory compliance, and then you apply standards of practice upon those to really up your game as it relates to quality of care. So I don't know how you felt about reading those reports, but that was hard for me to really read about what was happening in those reports and what they found.
And I agree with you. It was very difficult, and also to read those findings. Although we know that it did spark or continue the trajectory of this increased oversight and need for increased transparency, consistency, and ultimately enforcement actions. However, we also need to remember that these were egregious cases. And yet these are 12 beneficiaries, and we need to remember that we care for thousands of beneficiaries every day. And hospices, by and large, do an excellent job of ensuring quality and safe patient care. But that being said, the important component here is that all hospices need to be aware that they must be able to have these processes in place to ensure that they are providing this quality level of quality and safe care to all beneficiaries at all times, and that staff and management are aware of what, number one, what the regulations are and what standards of care that are expected, and how to demonstrate adherence to them, but also making sure that they continually monitor, and they are ready for these changes potential survey findings, because there are many hospices, not including these 12 cases, but many, many hospices that have a survey and are not prepared for the condition level deficiencies that may arise, or even immediate jeopardy. And so, while those cases were very disturbing, it's more of a warning for all hospices to recognize that they may feel confident that they're not providing that egregious level of care, but they must make sure that their care is, the documentation and the services that are provided support quality and safe care.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, there's that old adage of, a couple of bad apples in the barrel can ruin the barrel, And in essence, I think, some of that can be applied here, is that you have, for the most part, hospice providers are really providing good care out there, but you have a few out there, i.e., the cases in the reports where the care wasn't good, but that doesn't in essence mean the overall industry is providing poor care. But because of those, now we have this additional regulation. And you did talking about some of the changes to the survey process that are happening with these regulations, like increased transparency, and that we now have a permanent every 36 month survey that's just going to happen forever now. So what are some other things that the regs are showing as changing the survey process, Kim?
So this is also, for this question, it's important to differentiate between survey requirements and surveyor process changes that have resulted from the Hospice Act and the Home Health Final Rule and responsibilities for hospice providers in ensuring regulatory compliance. So the goal for the survey process changes, and I use the term surveyor process changes to differentiate. That's the Kim Skian term, not the CMS term, is to improve transparency and consistency with all survey results. So one of the there are a myriad of changes that CMS is implementing specifically to ensure greater consistency and oversight of surveys. So they will, one of the changes will be an enhanced state performance standard system where states must measure the degree of accuracy between surveyor findings and regulation and supervisory determinations and determining corrective actions. CMS will be conducting validation surveys of a representative sample of state survey agencies. This is already in place for AOs or accrediting organizations, but they will be ensuring that they conduct those validation surveys that for surveys that have condition level deficiencies, which were not identified when the initial survey was conducted. They'll analyze that disparity rate and then require a formal corrective action plan as part of the state survey agency or AO quality assurance program, and create objective measures for survey accuracy. So all of this is to, again, make sure that there is a sort of a cross evaluation of all survey agencies and frankly, all surveyors in terms of making sure that there is a greater element of consistency. They're also going to increase the transparency of survey findings by the accrediting organizations submitting and public reporting of the both the AO and state survey agency findings, and the requirement of the accrediting organizations such as CHAP to submit survey findings on what is now a CMS 2567, that's the form number, or a CMS approved form if they develop a different one in the future. There are also some new definitions of survey types that are clarified, as well as definitions of deficiencies and types and findings of compliance or non-compliance. Again, the goal is so that across all surveying entities and surveyors, there is consistency. You did talk about the survey frequency every 36 months. And also another component here that I just want to point out regarding survey frequency is that a standard or abbreviated survey is required in response to a complaint allegation to CMS, state or local or the local agency. And this is important because this is where we often will find that agencies are caught with survey findings at the condition level and sometimes immediate jeopardy where they were not prepared for survey because in the hospice's mind, they are preparing for their triennial survey, right, their every 3 year survey, which of course those hospices that are CHAP accredited or accredited have had triennial surveys for a long time, but they prepare just before, 6 months before, and they don't have an ongoing readiness process. So if a complaint comes in, let's say, 9 months or 12 months after the survey, the last survey, they can then have another survey, which may result in these findings. So that's why we really do strongly suggest an ongoing survey readiness program. There's some additional, such as the survey, their survey training. That is CMS basic survey training.
Yeah, right. That is our CHAP surveyors just completed. All of them have just completed. Maybe about a week ago, they went through that basic training.
Yeah. And that training there have been some enhancements made through CMS, and that is the standard that all surveyors, including AOs, are going to be going through that training. So that's excellent that CHAP has completed all of those requirements. And, you know, in addition, there's also conflict of interest now requirements. So what that means is CMS is prohibiting surveyors from conducting surveys for agencies which they've had a conflict of interest. Examples would be if they've been employed by or served as a consultant to the hospice in previous 2 years, or has a financial ownership, or immediate family member with a financial ownership in that hospice. And surveyors must disclose actual or perceived conflicts of interest and provide the opportunity to recuse themselves. And I will say that we've actually seen potential conflicts of interest in the past when we are working with organizations on plans of correction. And we actually have seen where, again, up until now, where surveyors may be involved in a survey. And most of the time we see it at the state survey level, but I'm certain, you know, up until now, it could also happen with AOs, but they previously had worked for the agency or, you know, left the agency in a less than positive manner. And then they are the surveyor. And right, whether that impacts their survey or not, the perception from the hospice is absolutely, you know, it does.
Well, it seems to level the fairness playing field by including those conflicts of interest criteria. So actually, I'm happy to see that included in there.
Me too. And then the other, which I think is an interesting add-on, if you will, to the regulations, is the use of multidisciplinary survey teams. And what this means is at least one member of the survey team must be an RN, but the teams also must include diverse professional backgrounds representing really the professional disciplines responsible for care. And that could include physicians, medical social workers, pastoral or other counselors. And I'm interested, Jennifer, in the plan for basically what this looks like from a survey perspective going forward for the survey entities, because certainly when we are working with agencies and providing survey assistance, you know, when you look at the survey protocols, the bulk of the survey or a large percentage of the survey revolves around clinical record documentation,
right,
home visit observation, and really reviewing a lot of it's certainly all interdisciplinary care, but nursing care and case management and clinical services. So I'm interested in, and you may not know this at this point in time, but how the survey agencies are going to be meeting the criteria as well as the timelines, you know, that the schedule, if you will, for survey, you know.
Yeah, I think because it's so new, I think it's something that, you know, CHAP and other surveying entities are trying to figure out, you know, how will we meet this? There'll probably be, you know, hopefully some additional guidance from CMS as time goes on. But yeah, it is new and it is going to be something that, you know, we're going to need to meet as a surveying entity. So, it's, you know, sometimes you're building the plane as you're flying it, when regulations come out. So, you know, we'll meet it and we'll do what we need to do at CHAP in order to be compliant. So Kim, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I actually believe that the interdisciplinary, the multidisciplinary survey team is a great opportunity to be able to review to see, you know, the other perspectives of the other disciplines such as social work, even physicians. I think the idea is good, and I think the practice is a great idea to implement. It's the question is more on the logistics,
right,
on how all of the survey requirements will be met, as well as making sure that you have the appropriate expertise, if you will, looking at the documentation. And it does not always have to be a nurse. I want to be clear about that, you know, but to your point, I think, you know, building the plane while flying is just sort of trying to make sure that we can navigate that while also ensuring that the hospices have, you know, really have, expertise and potentially oversight, you know, processes to make sure that all findings are reviewed from all facets. I don't know if that makes sense, but
no, it makes absolute sense. So, yeah. You know, there's a lot in the regulations that just came out about what state survey agencies have to do, AOs have to do as it relates to the survey process. But it's fair to say, I think, that the survey process itself is really not changing. But CMS did mention that they're going to have some focus on a couple of different COPs. And can you talk to us a little bit about what those COPs are, or and what they're trying to accomplish here?
Absolutely. So we know from looking at top survey deficiencies, and Jennifer, you and I have enough history where we can say hospice aide supervision is not one of the priorities that they're looking at, but we know that we really would like hospices to, you know, be to ensure compliance in those areas, in that particular area. But it's a quality, it's really looking at care planning and a comprehensive assessment. We know are the top, or make up most of the top 10, survey areas, as well as QAPI. And making sure, I would also add to that so those areas CMS is really looking at enhancing those particular survey areas among others. However, the other area that is of focus is also patient rights and IDG and coordination of care and infection prevention, surveillance and control, and emergency preparedness and pandemic planning, and COVID-19 response. And that is an area that, again, you won't find it outlined in Appendix M of the State Operations Manual, but we know in QSO memos and in, you know, current regulation updates to Appendix Z, and of course everything that is happening with the public health emergency, that these are areas that are targeted focus during survey, not just now, not just since 2020, but not just now in 2022, but will continue beyond.
Yeah, and all those vaccine requirements, that's a whole nother podcast, Kim. I have to tell you. Mm-hmm. It's just a whole nother, mm-hmm. It's a whole other barrel of beans right there. But yeah, those four core, as they named them out regulations, are something that providers, you know, they should be looking at everything, as you mentioned, but those four core is are COPs that really need to be perfect to the best of their ability, need to be implemented, need to be compliant, because we know that particularly plan of care really drives everything. Assessment and plan of care mm-hmm. drive everything else.
And just to add to that, we again, going back to those OIG reports, the first report in 2019 highlighted the top deficiencies. And sure enough, care planning and assessment and coordination of care were right there in the top, you know, those top findings. So this is a long-standing problem. And like I said, you can go to the QCOR website any of these survey findings across the country, and you're going to find that these top issues are still priority areas and the most common findings. And when you look at these findings or these areas, that the bulk of these findings stem from clinical record documentation, as well as home visits and evidence of that IDG coordination, communication, and care planning. So the focus on survey readiness, although we need to make sure all COPs are met, and that includes QAPI, which really QAPI is the implementation, the evidence of implementation of quality of oversight, if you will, and performance improvement when issues are identified. These other areas, we need to make sure that there is an ongoing process for concurrent record review, staff education, knowledge of case management principles, and direct observation in the home to make sure that these requirements are met.
Yeah, and we're actually going to talk about the top 10 Medicare survey deficiencies in another Chapcast down the line. So be interesting to sort of suss those out and look at them and see, you know, how each of those four core are figuring into those top 10. But Kim, I want to switch gears a little bit, and I want to talk about enforcement remedies. This is something that hospice providers have never had in the past, and this is like completely new for them, and it really a huge impact. So really quickly, I wanted to talk about what those enforcement remedies are so that providers have an idea of what is a possible application for non-compliance.
So enforcement remedies is considered by many to be the most significant component of the final rule that impacts hospices. And it's important to understand that Congress and CMS built these enforcement remedies in this new subpart N based on requirements in other settings. So even though these requirements are new to the remedies are new to hospice from a federal standpoint, they are not new to other settings. So it's also important to remember that in addition to these federal requirements, states may also impose enforcement remedies and penalties.
Right, great point.
And in fact, for several years, many years, in our work, my work, I have been appointed as a CMS independent consultant, or in this case, the term is temporary management, but independent consultant, specifically at the direction of either CMS or a state agency, when a hospice does require have remedies, including imposition of hold on patient admissions and penalties, et cetera. Your state may also already have these requirements, and you may have already been required on a state licensure side to have had these in place. So some organizations or some states are hospices in some states may be familiar, but from a federal standpoint, it's important that we understand what the enforcement remedies are, and the fact that they can be applied separately or together. So in other words, CMS can impose any number of the enforcement remedies based on the findings. So some of the remedies include temporary management, which means imposition of either an independent temporary manager or a manager from within the hospice organization, but not likely from the actual location that has been cited. It's typically that would apply if you have a corporate entity or another, a person who's not directly involved in the day-to-day activities being appointed as that temporary manager.
So does CMS appoint that temporary manager?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
So So the temporary manager must meet administrative requirements, first of all. The hospice must pay for the temporary management, but the individual is qualified or approved through CMS or the state's and or the state survey agency to be able to be appointed to that role. And that role can be in place for up to 6 months or until the hospice returns to substantial compliance. They have the ability to, the amount of time really does depend on the finding, but they have, the primary focus is to make sure that the plan of correction is implemented, the processes are implemented for sustained compliance with regulation, and not just related to the plan of correction. But they do have the ability to impact, make work with personnel decisions, financial decisions, et cetera. So the person in that role really does need to have a clear understanding of what the responsibilities are. And they report not just to the hospice, but they report to CMS or to the survey agency. To ensure compliance, that the processes are in place to ensure to get the agency back into compliance and ensure compliance. Some additional remedies include suspension of payment for new patient admissions. The original proposed rule had suspended payment for all patients, all Medicare patients, but the industry successfully advocated to reduce that or change that to suspension for new patient admissions, which of course still may be a significant financial hardship for some hospices, especially hospices that have short length of stay. So that it's, you know, that's an area that is of concern. Civil monetary penalties can be imposed, $500 to $10,000 per day or per instance. Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen it. I can personally say that on the federal side, on the home health side, we have seen civil monetary penalties on a daily basis. And on the state side for hospice, it's typically up until now has been a penalty, but not necessarily a per day instance. But and that per day instance can be imposed for each day of immediate jeopardy or from the last standard survey, including number of days of IJ. You don't have to be in immediate jeopardy to have civil monetary penalties. Right. So there's a lot to be weeded through with this. The bottom line is hospices want to make sure that they have, that they're in a position where they can avoid the potential for condition level deficiencies if at all possible.
Right.
And, you know, and because it's the extent to which deficiency poses immediate jeopardy, the nature, incidence, manner, and degree of the deficiencies for noncompliance, and also the presence of repeated condition level deficiencies.
Yeah.
So not just survey readiness, but if they've had a survey before and they've had prior condition level deficiencies, they need to make sure that the plan of correction that they've implemented results in sustained compliance and that they include that in their, we say in their QAPI program, ongoing, their ongoing monitoring to make sure that they do not have a repeat condition level deficiency.
Well, I'm thinking no hospice can afford to pay any fine like that for CMP. So compliance is the high road, folks, and that's what you should be taking to ensure you have compliance at any given moment. So I also see there are some other remedies like a directed plan of correction, a directed in-service training, and then it can even lead up to termination of a provider agreement as a remedy as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, the ability to, you may find as an example that a hospice may have a requirement for a directed plan of correction, directed in-service training, and temporary management, you know, as a combination, and maybe add on suspension of payment for all new patient admissions. And then you can overlay CMPs, but again, that will be CMS will be determining those findings. And you know, CHAP, you all will be the accrediting organization and survey organization for the survey itself. But any decision regarding enforcement remedies will be made by CMS in conjunction typically with the state survey agency.
Right.
So
right.
That, you know, and it does, it's a process. If anyone has any inkling of enforcement remedies, certainly we always advocate that they have counsel. And because there are appeal processes, you know, that can be put into place. But again, it's an area that you need to wade through. There's a lot of pieces, and to your point, have some direct financial impact. So the way to avoid all of that is to have, you know, to have a strong survey readiness process in the first place, and to the best of your ability, avoid condition level deficiencies. One other point regarding enforcement remedies is also that it's not just the history of condition level deficiencies, but if you're a multi-provider entity, then it's also looking across your organization to make sure that you don't have a pattern of deficiencies or condition level deficiencies in other locations, because ultimately CMS will be looking across organizations as well, to see if there's any history of repeated deficiencies.
Absolutely. And you sort of led us into our final topic here. So in the last couple of minutes that we have, Kim, in this podcast, you mentioned about development of a culture of ongoing survey readiness. So in this world that we have now that has been given to hospice providers, what are, you know, some of the quick tips that you could suggest for success?
Sure. Well, certainly an ongoing proactive survey readiness program implemented within the organization, educating all levels of your staff and management about the federal and state hospice regulations, including the COPs, and those focuses and changes related to COVID-19 and emergency preparedness should be part of your, and pandemic preparedness, part of your survey. Survey readiness plan. Ensure that training for orientation for new staff, especially since there have been so many staffing changes, and continuing education for all staff. Making sure that you have an ongoing review and observation process, meaning home visits and direct observation of agency processes such as IDG, to ensure staff knowledge and implementation of policies and procedures, and holding staff and managers accountable for their role in compliance with regulations, their role in survey, and responsibility for any follow-up. And as we talked about before, making sure that you have that process for ensuring that plans of correction based on prior survey findings are incorporated into that QAPI program monitoring to make sure that you have sustained compliance. And then again, having an understanding of what may constitute immediate jeopardy, because at times hospices are cited and not aware of the process that may lead to immediate jeopardy and think that it can't happen, but it at times can happen that hospices are not prepared. So although all COPs are important, the primary focus for the survey is on patient safety and avoidance of negative patient outcomes and implementation of best of standards of practice. So a robust process of monitoring patient care, service delivery, and response to patient needs is key. And though I would say that, you know, as well as understanding principles of case management, effective IDG coordination and communication, so that the hospice can demonstrate their ability to connect the dots to ensure safe and appropriate care and compliance with regulations.
That's great, Kim. I really appreciate all those great tips that you provided. And just for all of you out there listening, even though it's an optional complete the CHAP self-assessment, I think if you really want to be looking at all areas of your organization and your compliance, you know, consider completion of that self-assessment. So, Kim, thank you so, so much for joining the Chapcast today to talk about the new normal for hospice providers as it relates to some of the survey process changes and enforcement remedies. Any last thoughts for us?
No, just thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak with you, Jennifer, and with CHAP. We do support CHAP and the efforts that you do, the positive efforts that you have in place to be able to support your hospice providers. And I do concur that the self-assessment is a really solid way to be able to make sure that you're on target on an ongoing basis, and as well as the other tools that CHAP provides. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Kim. And thank you all for joining this Chapcast. Please tune in for future Chapcasts, where we'll be reviewing a whole array of different topics throughout the year. We appreciate all that you do as providers to people who need assistance out there. Please be safe and well, and we'll talk to you again soon.